Greetings and Sino-Retribulations, my reticularly Rubinius listeners, and welcome to this February 2019 Science News Update. I'm your host for this strangely monotonic science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. You're going to have to first forgive me, I'm coming off of a very sore throat, so hopefully you'll be able to follow along without getting too frustrated. So let's start off with an update on an idiot scientist of the month. I talked about John Kui He in December 2018, the science update then, and I'm actually beginning to feel sorry for the poor chowderhead at this point. Let me remind you of what happened. Dr. He was the center of an international firestorm following reports that babies were born that had their germline edited by him. The germline are the cells that are passed down to the next generation after you reproduce, your sex cells. This was last November, and he has now been fired by his university, the Southern University of Science and Technology in Sichuan, China. The university website said, quote, effective immediately, the Southern University of Science and Technology of Sichuan will rescind its work contract with Dr. Jian Ku He and terminate any of his teaching and research activities at the university, unquote. Dr. He's firing follows the release of an official Chinese investigation into his illegal actions. The official report says that beginning in June 2016, in pursuit of, quote, personal fame and fortune, unquote, he evaded supervision to conduct reproductive genetic editing experiments prohibited by the state. Yes, that is, the Chinese Communist state. And frankly, if you're going to annoy a state, Communist China is the one you should avoid. From March 2017 until last November, he recruited 8 volunteer couples in which the male was HIV positive. Dr. He was able to do this without oversight because he, quote, forged all the forms for the Ethical Review Board, unquote. Now, this is amazing for 2 reasons. First, because I guess I'm surprised that China has ethical review boards. So sorry about that. But second, that any single human being could be such a massive ass clown. He started his research by lying to the university on his ethics forms? Good one. What did he do then? Follow that up by, what, stealing candy from children and kicking puppies? What is wrong with this guy? Anyway, 2 of the volunteers became pregnant. 1 gave birth to Lulu and Nana, previously reported twins that I mentioned back in December. As far as we know, the other woman is still pregnant. According to the New York Times, the Chinese government report says, quote, this behavior seriously violates ethics and scientific research integrity, and seriously violates relevant state regulations, causing adverse effects at home and abroad, unquote. Yeah, how do you say duh in Chinese? Further, the head of the investigation team said that, quote, Dr. He, his colleagues, and relevant institutions will be dealt with seriously according to the laws, while the suspected crimes will be handed over to the public security organs, unquote. I suspect this is brown pants time for Dr. He. Again, this is the Chinese Communist government, which takes embarrassment of the state very seriously. And Dr. He gave the state a very red face. In the meantime, Guangdong Province, home of the university, will supervise the health of the genetically altered twin girls who have not been publicly identified. The worst part of living in a totalitarian state like China is that they take infractions of even the tiniest rules very seriously, and this did not involve breaking a minor law. At the end of December, Elsie Chen, a reporter for the New York Times, broke the news that Dr. He was being held under house arrest with his whole family at a guest house on the university campus. Chen photographed He on a balcony while under heavy security. That is scary as heck. In the U.S. or Europe, you do something like He did, and you will be heavily fined and lose your job. You will probably never get another job in academia again, but you will not likely go to jail. Your family should be unaffected, except in the most indirect way. In communist China, scarily, all bets are off. Not only may you end up serving hard time, but your family may be affected as well. If Dr. He disappears, he will either be breaking big rocks into little rocks somewhere, or working on the next super soldier genetic project for the Chinese government in a buried bunker in Manchuria. Well, whoever he creates won't be Captain America. Maybe Captain China? Captain Sino? Captain Asia? I guess we'll see. All right, first actual story of the evening. Killing chromosomes. Normal human cells have 46 chromosomes, and any deviation from this number, known as polyploidy, is typically lethal. Most chromosomes are simply too big with too many genes embedded in them to be able to have extra copies. Those extra genes churning out extra proteins are deadly, and the affected are never even born in most cases. In humans, the most common polyploidies are trisomies, which are characterized by the presence of one additional chromosome to give you three chromosomes as opposed to our usual two. These represent about 0.3% of all live births. The most common human trisomies are Down syndrome, which is associated with an extra chromosome 21, and Klinefelter syndrome, which is characterized by two X chromosomes and an extra chromosome Y. As I explained in my genetics classes, we can survive with an extra chromosome 21 because it is one of the smallest chromosomes with the fewest genes. We can survive with extra X chromosomes because any extra X is shut off and inactivated. We can even survive with extra Y chromosomes, again, because Y chromosomes are very tiny and there isn't a lot of extra stuff there. Because each chromosome contains hundreds of genes, the addition of even a single chromosome disturbs the delicate balance of gene products in cells. While the past decade has witnessed major advances in strategies to correct single gene defects of rare monogenic disorders, only a few attempts have been made to genetically correct the overdose of genes for an entire chromosome in polyploid cells. Now a study published in January in the journal Genome Biology reports the use of the CRISPR-Cas9 system to eliminate targeted chromosomes. Dr. Hui Yang of the Chinese Academy of Sciences was the lead author on the paper. There have been other methods over the years, but this is the first easy, efficient method to actually knock out entire chromosomes. And as I told you in previous podcasts, the CRISPR-Cas9 system depends on a single guide RNA that targets the Cas9 enzyme to specific genomic regions to induce double-strand DNA breaks, which are then repaired by non-homologous end-joining or homology-directed repairs. Harnessing the cell's own DNA repair machinery, researchers can add or delete pieces of genetic material or make changes to the DNA by replacing an existing segment with a customized piece of DNA. CRISPR-Cas9-mediated genome editing has been used to generate cells or animals carrying precise gene mutations, including the rearrangement or deletion of chromosomal segments. So in this new study, Yang used multiple cleavages induced by CRISPR at multiple chromosome target sites. Each separately generated CRISPR targeted one specific site to selectively eliminate a sex chromosome in cultured cells, embryos, or tissues in vivo. Yang also used this approach to produce a targeted autosome, that is, a non-sex cell loss, in polyploid mouse embryonic stem cells with an extra human chromosome. He did this also in human-induced pluripotent stem cells with a trisomy of 21, and he even did it in cancer cells. Yang says, quote, CRISPR-Cas9-mediated targeted chromosome elimination offers a new approach in developing animal models and therapeutic treatments for polyploidy. Our study is the first to report X, an autosome chromosome elimination via genome editing, unquote. The clinical application of CRISPR-Cas9-mediated chromosome elimination is not immediately obvious, but the authors suggest it has the potential to treat a broad spectrum of human tumors and even cure trisomies like Down syndrome, Klinefelter's, and XYY syndrome. Like Dr. Heeg's work, this type of repair needs to be done at the embryo level if it is to have any effect. You can't do those kind of repairs in a baby or even an embryo. There's just too many cells there. Yang explains, quote, CRISPR-Cas9 is like a scissors that can cut a tie 100 times. The chromosome would be destroyed beyond the limits of cell repair. Therefore, the targeted chromosome cannot participate in the process of DNA replication during cell division and will disappear in the offspring, unquote. All right, next story. Parkour. My son is nuts about parkour. Well, as long as it's on a video screen. And he's actually quite good at manipulating his original characters in a whole series of dangerous environments. If he ever actually decided he would try parkour in reality, I would step in immediately. It simply looks dangerous beyond belief. When I first saw parkour, it was probably about the same time that most people became aware of it. It was when Sebastian Faucon burst onto our movie screens in the opening sequence of Casino Royale as a terrorist pursued by James Bond through a building site. That's pretty much when it hit the mainstream. Faucon scrambled up vertical steel girders, bounded effortlessly across rooftops, he leapt down stairwells. His acrobatics were breathtaking and scary as heck. When physiologist Dr. James Croft of Edith Cowan University saw parkour, he wanted to understand how they use their bodies to pull off such daredevil stunts. Croft published his analysis in January in the Journal of Experimental Biology of how traceurs, as they're called, the people who actually do parkour, can scale a wall so easily. Croft says, quote, running up a vertical wall presents a unique set of challenges, and we wanted to know how traceurs could get over a wall. I first approached the Perth Parkour Association at one of their workshops for children. The athletes were keen to collaborate with us in the hopes of improving their skills, unquote. So Croft constructed a 3-meter-high plywood wall with a force plate embedded where the athlete's foot would land. His team then filmed each runner as they strode up the runway, pushed off from the force plate embedded on the ground, before glancing off the second force plate in the wall so that the team could measure the forces involved there. After recording 67 successful ascents, the trio reconstructed the traceurs' movements and realized they were moving almost horizontally at the instant when their foot landed ready for takeoff. The traceurs then propelled themselves upward as their training leg came forward. Croft noted the traceur's foot lands below hip height on the wall, allowing the runner to conserve much of the momentum gained during the run-up as they propel themselves upward. Most surprisingly, the athletes never straddled the floor and wall simultaneously, even though their coaches advised them to. Wondering which factors spell the difference between success and failure, Croft built a computer simulation, based on the assumption that the most successful strategy would be to use the least energy to predict the athlete's optimal tactic. Surprisingly, he discovered that the recipe for success lies in an intermediate run-up speed rather than a full-speed charge at the wall. Croft found that athletes are able to convert the energy they build up during the intermediate approach and use that to redirect themselves off the ground for a successful and efficient liftoff. He then asked, why don't they use an even slower run-up as it would be more efficient? According to Croft, a slower approach would result in the traceur hitting the takeoff with less momentum, requiring more exertion from the takeoff leg to make up for the slower approach, which is actually less efficient at the muscle level. And if the athletes charged at full speed down the runway, The takeoff leg would have to act as a shock absorber, which again would waste energy and wipe out the benefits of a faster approach. So, tracers naturally select an intermediate run-up speed, allowing them to use the least amount of energy as they effortlessly bound up walls to continue vaulting and defying gravity. Next story, the evolution of grandmas. Grandmas are great, generally speaking, but evolutionarily speaking, it's kind of puzzling why women past their reproductive years live so long. Grandma's age and how close she lives to her grandchildren can affect those children's survival. Now that has been suggested by two new studies published February 7th in the journal Current Biology. One of those studies found that among Finnish families in the 1700s to 1800s, the survival rate of young grandchildren increased 30% when their maternal grandmothers lived nearby and were 50 to 75 years old. The second study looked at whether that benefit in survival persists even when grandma lives far away. It doesn't, by the way. The studies are part of a broader effort to explain the existence of menopause, a rarity in the animal kingdom. The so-called grandmother hypothesis stipulates that, from an evolutionary standpoint, women's longevity is due to their contributions to their grandkids' survival, thus extending their own lineage. In the Finnish study, researchers wanted to know if grandmas eventually age out of their beneficial role. The team used records collected on the country's churchgoers born from 1731 to 1895, including 5,815 children. Women at that time had large families, averaging almost 6 children, with about a third of the children dying before age of 5. The team found that when maternal grandmothers living nearby were aged 50 to 75, their 2 to 5-year-old grandchildren had a 30% higher likelihood of survival than children whose paternal grandmothers were deceased. Similarly, paternal grandmothers and maternal grandmothers aged past 75 did not affect the children's overall survival. But when maternal grandmothers lived past age 75, their grandchildren's odds of dying before the age of 2 was 37% higher than a child with a deceased paternal grandmother. Dr. Simon Chapman at the University of Turku in Finland, who headed this study, states, quote, "We said it was a joke when we had the idea for this study. Oh, killer grandmothers, wouldn't that be a great story? And then we found it," unquote. In the second study, researchers wanted to know if the grandmother boost persisted even when families lived far apart. The team used data from 1608 to 1799, encompassing 3,382 maternal grandmothers and 56,767 grandchildren in Canada's St. Lawrence Valley. As with the Finnish population, those early French settlers had large families and high child mortality, but they also moved around a lot. For every 100 kilometers of distance between mothers and daughters, the daughters had 0.5 fewer children, the research found. Older sisters whose moms were alive when the women started having children had more children, and those children more likely to survive to age 15, compared with younger sisters who started having children after their mother's death. Once a maternal grandmother moved 350 kilometers away or more, her benefits ceased to exist, says study co-author Dr. Patrick Bergeron, evolutionary biologist at Bishop's University in Sherbrooke, Canada. Chapman concludes about the two studies, "These findings may explain an evolutionary reason for menopause, but may not hold true in today's modern world where people have fewer kids and live farther from home. What will be interesting to look at is whether or not the presence of a grandmother alleviates the sort of mental health problems plaguing children today," unquote. Next story, strep throat. Ugh. Yes, I am getting over strep throat, so this story is appropriate. My son got strep throat last week, which is what partially drew me to this next story, and my daughter had strep throat this week. And guess whose turn it was next? Neither my son nor my daughter gets strep throat very often, maybe once a year. But apparently there are kids out there who are seriously prone to strep, much more prone than once a year. Some kids get it again and again. It's also a problem little understood by scientists. Now a study that analyzed kids' tonsils hints at why such repeat infections may happen. The study came out February 6th in the journal Science Translational Medicine, and the work was done in the lab of Dr. Shane Crotty of the La Jolla Institute for Immunology. Crotty found that children with recurrent strep infections had smaller immune structures crucial to the development of antibodies in their tonsils than kids who didn't have repeat infections. Those who were frequently sore of throat were also more susceptible to a protein deployed by the bacteria that causes the infection that disrupts the body's immune response. In the study, Crotty examined tonsils, the immune tissue found in the back of the throat that had been removed from 5 to 18-year-olds. Some of the children had their tonsils taken out because of recurrent strep infections. Others had their tonsils removed to resolve sleep apnea caused by enlarged tonsils. This group was a proxy for kids not plagued by repeated bouts of strep. Crotty's team looked at sections of tissue under a microscope and found that kids with recurring strep had smaller immune structures called germinal centers, and the centers had fewer of a particular kind of immune cell, a type of T cell. Those T cells help other immune cells known as B cells, which make antibodies to fight body infections. And I think I've talked about them before. Crotty concludes with, the kids with recurrent strep also had fewer antibodies to a protein used by the bacteria called group A streptococcus that interferes with the immune response to the pathogen. That may make the children more susceptible to infections. Please remember that it's possible the seemingly defective immune response towards strep that we report could be due to some of those kids being carriers of the bacteria rather than actually having active strep infections. In future work, it will be helpful to determine which kids have true recurrent infections and which kids are strep carriers, unquote. All right, let's end the night with some astronomy news. Not sure my voice will go much farther anyway. A new study suggests Saturn's largest moon, Titan, gets some of its thick atmosphere by cooking organic molecules in a warm core. Yum. Makes me hungry just to think about it. Dr. Kelly Miller and her colleagues reported in the January 22nd issue of Astrophysical Journal about Titan in this story. It appears that the decay of radioactive elements may warm Titan's core from within, splitting nitrogen and carbon off from complex organic molecules. Once free, those elements can recombine into nitrogen and methane and escape into the atmosphere. That process may account for half the nitrogen and all the methane observed in Titan's atmosphere. Where Titan's thick nitrogen-rich haze comes from has long puzzled planetary scientists. Other moons are too small and cold to shroud themselves in gas. This is why Titan is the only moon big enough in our solar system to have an atmosphere. Previous studies suggested that Titan's nitrogen could have been delivered in the ammonia ice of comets. That ammonia could be split apart by sunlight or broken up by the force of a comet striking the moon's surface, creating the gaseous nitrogen molecules that fill Titan's skies. Miller says, quote, even a short time ago, I had this conception that comets are mostly ice with only a little bit of rock. I was surprised to see that 50% of the comet 67P was rock and organics, and only half was ice. Ammonia from comets could still donate nitrogen to Titan's atmosphere, but I wondered what role those organics might play too, unquote. In her new study, Miller and her colleagues figured that comets were likely the building blocks for Saturn's moons, since the Saturn system is so cold. The researchers assume that Titan's core was originally a sort of snowball built from comets. Given the insights from Comet 67P, the team calculated what ingredients Titan would have started out with and how those ingredients could change over time. Titan's thick atmosphere, plus a subsurface ocean, a hydrologic system of hydrocarbon lakes, rivers, and rain, and a veneer of organic compounds and other life-friendly molecules, make the moon a popular target for the search for alien life. So far, organics have only been detected on Titan's surface, but hints that organic compounds may exist in the core means that the molecules may also exist at the bottom of Titan's subsurface ocean, an environment that could be a cozy cradle for life. Miller finishes up the paper with this statement, quote, "The thing that excites us the most is the idea that those complex organic molecules are already in Titan's core. That makes it one step easier to think about habitable environments at the base of Titan's ocean," unquote. Well, that's all for now. Happy Chinese New Year of the Pig. Remember, an intermediate speed is better when you want to jump a wall. Live near Grandma. Keep watching Titan Skies, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.